I have on my notes that we stopped last time with verse 7. Is that correct? Chapter 21 and verse 7. So as we have been walking through this, just working through all of these reasons why God is right in his judgment of the people of Israel, right? He did not make a mistake when he brought Babylon, when he brought Assyria and Babylon in to bring discipline to his people and to carry them off into captivity, right? His judgment was just. And we've seen some horrible descriptions. Well, they were good descriptions of horrible things. Let's put it that way, right? They were good descriptions of horrible things. And we're going to see another one of those soon. But the sin is graphic. Ezekiel's writing is such that it at times unsettles us, which is good. We kind of like Paul's writings are a little easier for us, we think. Peter's writings, Peter says what? That some of Paul's writings are hard to understand. And I always think, hey, Peter, maybe you shouldn't talk quite so much on that one, right? Because there's parts of Peter that are hard to understand, right? But Ezekiel is just pounding away on proving the sinfulness of the people of Israel. And they have sinned again and again and again and again. And we saw last time in chapter 20 the expressions "for the sake of my name" in verse 9 and 14, verse 22 and verse 44, that God was doing what he's doing. Right? We use the expression God is self-referential. He is wanting people to think about him. Now, God can do that because for God that is not sinful. We do that, right? And that is sinful because God wants us to get people to think about God rather than us, right? Because we're always going to take what people think about us and it's going to be distorted, right? We're going to get inflated and puffed up and we're going to become arrogant and all sort. And we're actually going to believe compliments that people give to us, and that's not helpful, right, in our Christian walk. But God desires and deserves to be praised. And he wants people to focus upon him. He wants people to love him with all of their heart, soul, mind, and strength. And so when he says, I'm doing this for the sake of my name, that's his ultimate goal. He also said in verses 12, verse 20, and verse 26, he says, I'm doing this so that you might know. Right? It's not merely educational, but there is clearly an intent. He wants people to know that he is Yahweh. He wants them to know that he is the self-existing God. And we live in a culture where there are many gods and goddesses. There are the, well, I guess I was going to save this for later, but Mark loaned me this. Have you seen this one, American Gospel? The video, American Gospel. Don't watch it with my wife, because she'll get frustrated again. But it's frustrating, because these are people who, in the name of Christ, are telling people that they are actually gods. Right? You are gods, and there's one God, right? There's one God. And it's worth watching. It's just frustrating. You just want to shake them. But God wants everyone to know that he alone is the self-existing God, right? That's what he did in the Exodus. You can go through those early chapters in the book of Exodus, and you will see God says, I'm doing this so that you will know that I am Yahweh. And he is saying the same thing again to the people of Israel. And then in verses 38, verse 42, and verse 44, he gives us the promise in chapter 20, verse 38. Oops, I meant one page over. He says, and I will purge from you the rebels and those who transgress against me, and I will bring them out of the land where they sojourn, but they will not enter the land of Israel. Thus you will know that I am Yahweh. In other words, his intent will be successful. Okay? You will know that I am Yahweh. And that happens again in verse 42. And you will know that I am Yahweh when I bring you unto the land of Israel, into the land which I swore to give to your fathers. And then restated in verse 44. Then you will know that I am Yahweh when I have dealt with you for my name's sake. Not according to your evil ways or according to your corrupt deeds, O house of Israel, declares Lord Yahweh, or Adonai Yahweh, the sovereign Yahweh. So that's his purpose there in chapter 20. As we then looked at that puzzling parable in verses 45 through 49 about the trees in the wilderness, which, again, did anybody pursue that any further? One thought I had is perhaps at one time there was actually a forest out there, right? And that's very possible, but there just aren't many trees out there at this point in time. And maybe in Ezekiel's day there was, and that would have all made great sense to them. But for me, it still is a puzzle. So that brought us to the drawn sword in chapter 21, verses 1 through 7, and we talked about the difference in some of the Hebrew manuscripts here, that some of them are plural about in verse 2, dripping out words against the sanctuaries, plural. And if that is indeed plural, then that would be a reference to all of the worship, the false gods and goddesses, and the different shrines throughout the land of Israel, which Israel, that was Israel's predominant sin, right? Idolatry. If it is singular, then it would probably be a reference to the temple in Jerusalem. Bring that judgment in Jerusalem upon the temple there when Babylon comes and destroys things indiscriminately. Well, that led us then where we want to begin this evening, verse 8 of chapter 21. And verses 8 through 13, you can see here that says, the word of Yahweh came to me, saying, Son of man, prophesy and say, thus says. Now notice again the typeset of the names of God are important, right? So the one capital letter, then this would be the name Adonai, okay? The meaning my Lord or my Master, the Sovereign One. So it's a little bit different than what he's been saying as far as the word of Yahweh. This thus says the Sovereign One. Say, a sword sharpened and also polished, sharpened to make a slaughter, polished to flash like lightning. Or shall we rejoice in the scepter of my son? The sword despises every tree. It is given to be polished, that it may be seized by the hand, that the sword is sharpened and polished to give it into the hand of the one who kills. Cry out and wail, son of man, for it is against my people, it is against all the princes of Israel. They are delivered over to the sword with my people. Therefore, slap your thigh, for there is a testing. And what if even the scepter which the sword despises will be no more, declares Adonai Yahweh. So we see here this preparation, the sharpening, the polishing, making sure the sword is ready to go. But this sword is going to be used by God to discipline his people. He's going to discipline the common people. He's going to discipline the leadership. He's going to discipline the princes of Israel. We know that when the Babylonians come in, they destroy the family line of David, right? And we're left with no king in the land of Israel. Well, what are we going to do? How are God's promises going to be fulfilled? How is God's covenant with David going to be fulfilled? The answer is what? Messiah will come, right? And the hope that he will come, he will fulfill, as Jacob promised in Genesis 49, what God spoke to David in 2 Samuel 7. God's point is for Israel, And this is hard, and this is hard for us to grasp as well. And we've asked this question many times before. From whom or from what does God save us?
God's wrath.
Saves us from his wrath. He saves us from our sin. He saves us from himself. Right? So what do we tell? We tell ourselves, we tell others, your only hope is your judge. Right? Say, well, but he's my judge. That's bad. No. Your judge is good. Right? Run to the judge. So we, yeah, but I'm guilty. That's why you run to the judge. Right? Go to the one who can do something about your sin. That's what Ezekiel is telling God's people here. Now, in verses 14 through 17, there's this interesting description. You therefore, son of man, prophesy and strike your hands together. Now again, this is more of a cultural thing. Strike your hands together. Now we do this, right? We can clap in a variety of different ways, right? We can give the pity clap, right? Or we can give the sarcastic clap. That was good, right? We can do it that way. We can do a joyful clap. There's a variety of different ways. We can do the required clap at the end of a performance, and everybody else is clapping, and so we kind of go along with it because we're supposed to, right? There's different ways. Here is a clap of, it's a mockery. It's a recognition that you're getting what you're deserving. That you're getting what you deserve. So when he says, prophesy and strike your hands together, that's not a cheerful clap. Let the sword be doubled the third time, the sword for the slain. It is the sword for the great one slain which surrounds them, that their hearts may melt. And many will be stumbling blocks at all their gates. I have given the glittering sword. Ah, it is made for striking like lightning. It is wrapped up in readiness for slaughter. So again, this is not a sword for parade, right? Sometimes you see that on Antiques Roadshow, right? Oh, we found this officer's sword from the Civil War. Well, yeah, it was never used in battle, right? It was for parade. This is not that, right? This is to be used. Show yourself sharp. Go to the right. Set yourself. Go to the left. Wherever your edge is appointed, and I will also strike my hands together, God says. And I will cause my wrath to be at rest. I, Yahweh, have spoken. So as Daniel Block says in his helpful commentary on Ezekiel, Yahweh will have the last clap and the last word. Okay? Daniel Block's commentary, I know it's really detailed, and sometimes you have to wade through some pretty deep stuff, but it is still worthwhile. But the point is, God says, I'm the one who is doing this. I am the one who is going to make sure this sword accomplishes what I have intended. I will also strike my hands. I will cause my wrath to be at rest. God is behind this. Now, yeah, it's the Babylonians. We know that. But who's behind the Babylonians ultimately, right? Just as Acts 2 and Acts 4, as the early church is describing the suffering and the death of Christ, what are they saying? That God did this by the hands of the Jewish leadership, by the hands of the Romans. So who killed Jesus? Well, the Jews did. Who killed Jesus? The Romans did. Who killed Jesus? I did. Who killed Jesus? God the Father did. Right? It's perspective. And if we want to focus on just the immediate thing, we can say, oh, look at those bad Babylonians. But ultimately, the Babylonians are being used to accomplish God's purpose. Just as the Romans did, just as Pilate did, just as the Sanhedrin did, right? The Jewish Sanhedrin. So that leads us to verses 18 through 27. The sword is directed against Jerusalem. So there is the ultimate sword of God's judgment, and there is the immediate sword of the Babylonian king. It says, "The word of Yahweh came to me, saying, Now as for you, son of man, make two ways for the sword of the king of Babylon to come. Both of them will go out of one land, and make a signpost. Make it at the head of the way to the city." In other words, it's a road sign, right? That's what it says. We had the opportunity, we had to run to Mankato for something today, and road signs, right? Highway 169 is closed, but if you want to go to 169, you got and all these signs, and signs here, and signs, it's great. You got to go there just to experience that. But it's directions, right? That's the whole point. Signs are pointing us to something. And God says to Ezekiel, make a road sign and give the king of Babylon some direction. Verse 20, "You shall mark a way for the sword to come to Rabbah of the sons of Ammon." In other words, it's going to go to the east of the Jordan River into what we understand as the country of Jordan today. But also to Judah into fortified Jerusalem. So what God is saying to Ezekiel, whoops, I got to make this, we'll zoom out here and do it this way. So with Jerusalem, as Babylon comes down from the north, God says to Ezekiel, I want you to put up a road sign. Now, they can either come down here and attack Jerusalem from the north, which is what they'll do eventually, or they can cut across the river. Okay. If you're going to attack Jerusalem, the best direction to attack Jerusalem is always from the north. Okay. Everything else is hills, right? Which is God put them there on purpose, right, to be surrounded by the hills so that when people were traveling out in this direction, that they would look up and see the mountains, look and see the hills, but they wouldn't see Jerusalem. Jerusalem was protected. If you come from the north, that's about all you can see is Jerusalem, right? And it's easy to get to Jerusalem from the north, and that's what is being described here. The Babylonians will approach from the north. One road will branch off to the left and lead down the east side of the Jordan River to Amman, Jordan. The other, as I have on page 29, the other road would veer to the right and lead down to the west of the Jordan to Jerusalem. Verse 21 tells us then that the king of Babylon stands at the parting of the way at the head of the two ways. So in other words, he's standing there like most of us and trying to figure out which way should I go. Right? He's got two choices. Now, I've given us some really, and you get extra points if you can pronounce all these words, and you get extra points if you can spell them all next week for open forum. But there's some unusual things here, and this is pre-GPS, right? So this is what, there were at least three things described here. One is the shaking of arrows, which seems to be putting the arrows in the quiver, shaking them up, and then dumping them out. Kind of like, what was that game when we were little kids? Pick-up sticks, right? Similar thing, right? And then you have to decide which one really means something more than all the other ones that fell out of the quiver. That's called bellomancy or rhabdomancy. Y'all wanted to know that, but it's a thing, actually. Another way of doing it was to consult with your idols, which oftentimes were representative of, sometimes, of dead people. It was also known as necromancy, right? Dead things, right? Dead people. The other, and this is one of my favorites, is the examination of the irregularities of sheep's liver. Because it's like, we all know what sheep's liver should look like.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. It's like, so you would obviously have to slaughter the animal, and you would then evaluate the liver, known as, and this is hard to pronounce, hepatoscopy or hepatomancy, having to do with the liver, right? Hepatitis, right? So the point is, somebody's got to kill the animal, and somebody's got to dig in there and pull that out and then evaluate it, right? Sounds like great fun. But this is how decisions were made. How about flipping a coin, right? That would be one thing. It would be less bloody. But these were ways in which the Babylonians made decisions. Now, you have two ways, right? You have two choices. You can either go to across the east, or you can go on the west side and go up to Jerusalem. So here is Nebuchadnezzar trying to figure out which way he should go, and he's not listening to his GPS telling him what he should do. So household idols, arrows, and the liver. Verse 22, into his right hand came the divination Jerusalem. So he got an answer. Now, is that a demonic answer? Or was it an answer from God to bring judgment upon the people of Jerusalem? That's a puzzle, isn't it? God is ultimately, now, doesn't Joseph do some divination back in the book of Genesis? Not advocating that we all go out and practice divination, right? However, God can still use the foolishness of humanity to accomplish his purpose. Now look what it says, that he got the answer, Jerusalem, to set up battering rams, to open the mouth for killing, to lift up the voice with a shout of war, to set battering rams against the gates, to cast up ramps, to build a siege wall. And that's an awful lot of military preparation. And it will be to them like a worthless divination in their eyes. They have sworn solemn oaths, but he brings iniquity to remembrance that they may be seized. So God is going to use Nebuchadnezzar to accomplish God's purpose. And this discipline, this punishment needs to come. Verse 24, therefore thus says Adonai Yahweh, because you have made your iniquity to be remembered, you wanted people to know how wicked you really are. And this is even before Facebook, right? This is before social media, when we brag about sinful things, right? God says, you want people to remember your sin, in that your transgressions are uncovered, so that in all your deeds, your sins appear. Because you have come to remembrance, you will be seized with the hand. What do you want to be known for? Right? What do you want people to remember about you? Apparently for them, it was, well, he was a good sinner, right? He sinned better than so many other people. Horrible, horrible thoughts. And you, O slain, wicked one, the prince of Israel, whose day has come in the time of the iniquity of the end, thus says Adonai Yahweh, remove the turban and take off the crown. This will no longer be the same. Make high that which is low, and make low that which is high. And verse 27, and notice the triplicate here. That's not a typo. a ruin, a ruin, a ruin. That's the strongest way to emphasize that. God says, I will make it. Now, you can say something one time. You can duplicate it. Now, this by the way, is similar to what we see in Hebrews 13, right? God says, I will never, ever leave you. And then what? I will never, ever, ever forsake you. That's a triplicate again there. That's the strongest way to say it in the Hebrew language. So here is, you will be ruined. God says, I will make it. This also will be no more until he comes to whom the legal judgment belongs, and I will give it to him. In other words, what? You're going to be in ruin until Messiah comes. And I'm sending Messiah, and he has the legal right to sit on the throne, and what? I will give it to him. It'll be undeniable, unmistakable. So there will be no valid claims to the throne in Jerusalem until Jesus rides into Jerusalem on a donkey in 33 AD, right? Which is what do they say, right? When he comes in, what we refer to as Palm Sunday, right? They say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, right? They sing hallelujah, right? And yet Jesus is not embraced as king. Though he is announced as king, he is not embraced as king at that time. Well, then lastly, real quickly, verse 28 through 32. Now as for you, son of man, prophesy and say, thus says Adonai Yahweh concerning the sons of Ammon and concerning their reproach. And say, a sword is drawn, polished for the slaughter, to cause it to consume that it may be like lightning. And while they behold for you worthless visions, while they divine lies for you, to place you on the necks of the wicked who are slain, whose day has come in the time of the iniquity of the end, return it to its sheath. In the place where you were created, in the land of your origin, I will judge you, and I will pour out my indignation on you. I will blow on you with the fire of my fury, and I will give you into the hand of brutal men, craftsmen of destruction. What a description that is. People who are skilled and excel at destruction. You will be a fuel for the fire. Your blood will be in the midst of the land. You will not be remembered, for I, Yahweh, have spoken. So again, the judgment will come upon modern, what is today Jordan, the city of Ammon. It may be delayed, but it is still guaranteed. And the sword of Babylon will be sheathed because God will be done with it, right? Until a future time. Ironically, Babylon itself will experience God's wrath, right? So, just because you're being used of God for this particular thing doesn't take you off the hook, right? You still are deserving of your punishment. All right, let me pause there. I know we raced through that, but just to give you that understanding of what is going to take place as Babylon comes from the north and ultimately says to Jerusalem, we're done, right? You guys are done. You've messed around for so long. He came in 605, he came again in 597, and then ultimately in 586. He's given them opportunities to repent, to quit horsing around, to quit dilly-dallying with Egypt or wherever they've been going. Just submit, right? Submit to the king. Submit to the king of Babylon. And Israel plays games with him, and finally he just says, enough's enough. And God disciplines them. And the severity and the destruction of Jerusalem is about on the same level as what the Romans did in AD 70. It was horrific. So, all right, any questions or comments before we try to move on a little bit? Chapter 22. Go ahead.
As prophecies go, this is so specific. I mean,
Yeah, that the time for mercy has ended. Yeah, the time for now his mercy endures forever. We know that from numerous passages. At the same time, that does not eliminate the need for discipline and judgment. And he has given them not good at math, but he's given them 800 years of opportunity, prophet after prophet, word of the Lord after word of the Lord, miracles by the hands of different prophets, and they have said, we're still going to do what we want to do. Yeah, 800 years of sticking their fingers in their ears and going, la, 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 we're not going to listen, right? So 800 years, and that's a long time for God to be patient, right? But his patience come to an end. Yeah. So, yeah, good observation. Anything else before we move on? All right, let's see if we can get a little further here in chapter 22. So, verses 1 through 16, the first revelation that is given regarding Jerusalem, and it is primarily about their idolatry once again and their violence in verses 1 through 5. The word of Yahweh came to me saying, now as for you, son of man, will you judge, will you judge? Notice how it's described. The city of blood. That's not a compliment, right? That is the city of violence, the city of bloodshed. Then you shall cause her to know all her abominations, and you shall say, thus says Adonai Yahweh, a city shedding blood in her midst, so that her time will come, and she makes idols against herself for defilement. You have become guilty by the blood which you have shed, and defiled by your idols which you have made. Thus you have brought your day near and have come to your years. That just what we just described. The time has come to an end. And it's whose fault? It's your fault. Therefore, I have made you a reproach to the nations and a mocking to all the lands. Right? In a culture, in a shame-based culture. Right? That's what this is describing. Right? You want to avoid whatever you can to avoid shame. You don't want people are looking at you and going, right? You want to have a good reputation. You want people to look at you and there's to be honor and respect. God says, no, that's not what's going to happen. People are going to look upon you and that you will be, I have made you a reproach to the nations, a mocking to all the lands. Those who are near and those who are far from you will mock you. You of unclean name, full of turmoil. In other words, this is going to spread across the internet faster than anything, right? This is going to spread across the known world. And people are going to talk about what happened to Israel. So he says, your violence and your idolatry. Yahweh, I have typed in there for you in the middle of page 29 there. Yahweh cannot stand idly by while life is cheapened and his claim to exclusive allegiance is trampled underfoot. Right? You want God just to do nothing? What kind of a God is that? So God steps up, so to speak, and he is always active. It's just he doesn't always do it, so to speak, by pulling the curtain. Sometimes he does things behind the curtain. And now God is visibly and noticeably active. Which leads us to verses 6 through 12. Behold, the princes of Israel, each according to his power, have been in you for the purpose of shedding blood. They have treated father and mother with contempt within you. Wow. Right? What were they supposed to do? Right? Honor your father and mother, right? The sojourner, they have oppressed in your midst. That's the very opposite of what they should have done. The fatherless and the widow, they have mistreated in you. Again, the most vulnerable. Right? They should have shown mercy. They have not. You have despised, verse 8, you have despised my holy things and profaned my Sabbaths. Again, what were you supposed to do with the Sabbath, right? Remember the Sabbath to keep it holy, to keep it, set it apart, right? Slanderous men have been in you for the purpose of shedding blood, and in you they have eaten at the mountain shrines. In your midst they have done acts of lewdness. In you they have uncovered their father's nakedness. In you they have humbled her who was unclean in her menstrual impurity. One who has also done what is an abomination with his neighbor's wife, and another has lewdly defiled his daughter-in-law, and another in you has violated his sister, his father's daughter. All of those descriptions, all of those commands in the book of Leviticus about sexual purity, you've just thrown it out. If you have no care, no interest, no desire to be holy. Again, these are again, sometime I just need to immerse myself in this, but I'm convinced that what Ezekiel is doing throughout his book, and I just need to go through and verify all this, that he's going through and thinking through the book of Leviticus as he's writing about the sins of the people of Israel. He's a priest. That's his job, right? And I think what he's saying as he's highlighting these things, these are all echoes from the book of Leviticus. Not all, but many of them are from the book of Leviticus, and so it rings there, and people are being reminded of that. Now, we don't like the book of Leviticus because it's just so detailed on all these things. Well, the whole point was what? The lordship of Yahweh. God is interested in every aspect of your life. In all of your life, you are called to be holy. What Ezekiel is describing here is in all of your life, you are unholy. Right? That's what he's describing. Verse 12, in you they have taken bribes for the purpose of shedding blood. You have taken interest and profits, and you have injured your neighbors for gain by oppression. And here, I think, is probably the root. You have forgotten me, declares Adonai Yahweh. John MacArthur says in his commentary regarding this, they have done all the evil they could. They have excelled. Right? It's not something you should excel with, but that's what they have done. Ralph Alexander says, when one forgets God and leaves God's ways, is the idea, the path into every kind of abomination opens before him. Now, over the years, as I've interacted with people as pastor, and you watch people who say, yeah, I'm a Christian, and yet there comes a time where certain professing people, there's a point where a decision appears to be made, and we have the expression in American English, they go off the deep end. And you watch people who at one time made a profession of faith, and they're engaged in some of the most bizarre, sinful behavior, right? And you just... That's what he's describing here. These are the people of God, right? This is the people of Israel. How is it that they can be engaged in these things and no one says stop, right? Now, Ezekiel's trying to get them to stop, right? And there have been other prophets, but nobody has listened. There is abundant evidence that they have abandoned Yahweh's covenant stipulations. Again, remember Leviticus? Remember in Deuteronomy, God says, if you do this, right? Obedience will bring blessing. Disobedience brings curses, right? And they said on more than one occasion, all that Yahweh has said, we will do. Until we have to, right? It's easy to make that claim to want to be a follower of Yahweh. But what about tomorrow, right? What about in the afternoon? What about in the evening, right? What about at work? What about at home? And as you read through this, as we've read all of these things, you're reading a culture that is disintegrating, right? A culture that is imploding. God says, you have earned your discipline. You have earned your punishment. Verse 13. We got time. Now behold, I have struck my hand at your greedy gain which you have acquired and at the bloodshed which is among you. Can your heart stand, or can your hands be strong in the day that I will act against you? It's kind of the idea here of you really want to take me on? Kind of the idea, you know what I'm saying? You really want to deal with this? I, Yahweh, have spoken and will act. I will scatter you among the nations, which means what? Who wins this confrontation, right? God wins. I will scatter you among the nations, and I will disperse you throughout the lands, and I will put an end to your uncleanness from you. You will profane yourself in the sight of the nations, and you will know that I am Yahweh. So Yahweh's response to them, and again, I think rooted in Leviticus chapter 26, God says, I will fulfill, at least partially, the curses that I said I would bring upon you. God will keep his word. Which leads us then, I think we still have time for a little bit more. Let's look at verses 17 through 22. And the word of Yahweh came to me, saying, Son of man, the house of Israel has become dross to me. All of them, and maybe we should ask Caleb about all these different metals here, but they are bronze and tin and iron and lead in the furnace. They are the dross of silver. Therefore, thus says Adonai Yahweh, because all of you have become dross, therefore, behold, I am going to gather you into the midst of Jerusalem. As they gather silver and bronze and iron and lead and tin into the furnace to blow fire on it in order to melt it, so I will gather you in my anger and in my wrath, and I will lay you there and melt you. Now again, it's the word picture. He's not melting human bodies here. It's the word picture, right? Verse 21, and I will collect you together and blow on you with the fire of my fury, and you will be melted in the midst of it. As silver is melted in the furnace, so you will be melted in the midst of it, and you will know that I, Yahweh, have poured out my wrath on you. There's an old illustration, and I have never personally seen this. I'm taking somebody's word for this. But based upon people who have seen the melting pots of these different types of metals, is melting it off, and what happens? The impurities float to the surface, right? And then that gets skimmed off, and it gets heated again, and you just keep heating and heating and as the impurities float to the surface. One metal, and don't ask me which one, but there is one metal that when melted, the individual doing the smelting process can look into the metal, and he knows when the impurities are gone by how? By being able to see his reflection in the melted metal. Okay. Now, I think that is similar to what God does in our lives. He wants to see his image reflected, right? Now, melting and smelting are not a fun thing, right? I don't know what the temperatures are. Do you guys do any melting of metal out there? Yeah. Torching, yeah. Yeah. But to remove the impurities takes an enormous amount of heat, right? And it's an uncomfortable thing and it's an unpleasant thing. But it's the end result, right? That's what you're looking for. The pure metal, the pure gold, the pure silver, the different metals that are described here. God desires purity in them. And this smelting process, as you can see in Deuteronomy 4, and I've given you other references there, that Egypt was understood as the original smelting furnace. One of the reasons they were in Egypt was what? To get their attention, right? To get them back to where they should be after those 400 years. Now, however, the smelting furnace has moved to Jerusalem. And so God's judgment and God's purification of Israel will lead to a better understanding of God during the exile. Isn't that what you desire? Right? In our saner moments, right? We sang this evening, "Oh, for grace to love him more." This is our complaint, is that our love is weak and faint. Right? I want to love God more. And that's a good aspiration, and we should. But oftentimes that comes, that growth in our love and the intensification of our love is going to come through this purification process, right? That's what God is doing for Israel here. God is putting them into the smelting furnace, and the end result will be, "And you will know that I, Yahweh, have poured out my wrath on you." You will go, "Yeah." Right? Now, isn't a similar thing? Now, it's not the same. I know there's a significant time difference, but part of in Philippians 2, doesn't God say that there's coming a day when every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, right? To the glory of God the Father. Now, I think there are people who will bow joyfully, right? Believers will bow and confess joyfully that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. I think there are others who will bow, unbelievers who will still bow and who will still confess Jesus Christ is Lord. Right? Now, it's not done with joy. It's not done with repentance, but it is done with a recognition that, yes, he is Lord, and I deserve the punishment that I receive. Right? So I think Israel here, when you look at the dross in verse 6 through verse 16, all of those sins, and those are just representatives, right? But that's dross that needs to be melted away. Perhaps it will be melted away in the time of the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem. Perhaps it will be melted away while they're in exile. Remember our study in Ezra and Nehemiah. They came back from exile. Some came back in genuine faith. Most did not, right? But they liked getting out of exile, right? We like, you know, again, it's a similar thing in our culture. As my wife and I interact with people in real estate issues people leaving larger metro areas and coming out here into the boondocks, they like Mayberry, right, out here, because we don't steal your stuff, right? But we don't necessarily want what is necessary in order for there to be a Mayberry atmosphere, which comes as a result of Judeo-Christian ethics, right? But I really like the fact that you don't steal my stuff. And I don't have to lock my doors. And I can leave my keys in my car because I know you're not going to steal them, right? Because people are just assuming they're going to be mistreated, right? I'll never forget a couple of young ladies, one from the West Coast, one from the East Coast. And are there places in Sleepy Eye where I should not go by myself? Well, I don't know, those people around First Avenue are a little sketchy, but no. But it's like, well,
you know it.
It's like, yeah, you know, it's pretty safe. Yeah. Police officers normally struggle from boredom, right? Around this in southern Minnesota. It's a known thing. It's boredom is a serious problem for law enforcement out here. But we still struggle with these sins, this dross that Israel struggled with. We struggle with those same things, right? Israel had given up trying to even stop it. At least here out in the rural parts here, there is still a collective conscience yet, though. Right, there's still an awareness that there are certain things you just ought not to do. Right? Now, we're losing some of that. I recognize that. But Israel had just given up. In fact, they had got more than given up. They now were applauding those who were sinning. And they wanted to wanted their reputation to be known as the one who could sin, right? That was chapter 21. You have made your iniquity to be remembered. You should be ashamed of it. But now you want your name in the newspaper for, you know, the most wicked? Right? That's how you want to be known? Your transgressions are uncovered so that in all your deeds, your sins appear. So we can marvel at God's infinite wisdom in bringing Israel to this place. We marvel at the end of he's still patient because he is a God of patience, right? He doesn't stop being patient, but he also exercises his justice and his judgment and his wrath and his anger. His patience is still there, but he's also needs to exercise these in the display of his holiness to bring his people back to where they ought to be. Well, let's stop there. We'll pick up with, in 2 weeks, we'll pick up with verse 23, the recipients of Israel's judgment. But this evening, I trust that you'll recognize that the point here with Ezekiel, God communicating with Ezekiel, is you need to take sin seriously because you take God seriously, right? That's why you need to know your God. That's why it is so vital that we have a biblical understanding of the character of God. Because that then impacts how we look at sin, how we look at righteousness, how we look at all of these in verses 6 through 16, how you treat your father and mother, how you treat the sojourner, how you treat the fatherless and the widow, how you treat holy time and holy places, how you treat your neighbors, how you worship, how you treat your parents, how you engage or not engage in sexual activities, how you handle finances. All those things are involved there, and sin contaminates all of that, and that all needs to be purified. And as we will see, there's coming that time in the book of Ezekiel when they, because he has demonstrated for chapter after chapter after chapter that they are not able to do these things, they are not able to be obedient, he says, now I will make a new covenant with you, and you will obey. Right? So look forward to getting to that eventually.